Welcome to episode 132 of Breakout Culture. I'm Charlotte Metcalf. I'm the associate editor at Country and Townhouse magazine.
And I'm Ed Vasey. I'm the culture editor at Country and Townhouse magazine. And today we're thrilled to be talking to William Boyd, one of our greatest living novelists. He's also a prolific screenwriter and a playwright. He's garnered multiple accolades and awards along the way, including a BAFTA television award for the best drama serial of any human heart.
Yes, now William's written 22 works of fiction alone, and most of our writers will have read at the very least one of them, whether it's Any Human Heart, which Ed just mentioned, Brazzaville Beach, or A Good Man in Africa. But his output is
I think I've read all three of those.
Me too. But his output is so prolific that he's also had 20 screenplays produced, 3 stage plays and 5 radio plays. And those are besides the others he's written and had published. William's here with us today to talk not just about his most recent novel, The Romantic, but also to tell us about a new book, The Mirror and the Road, which comprises a collection of conversations William has had about his work with the acclaimed interviewer Alistair Owen. William, good morning and welcome to the podcast.
Morning. Very happy to be here. Thank you, Charlotte. Thank you, Ed.
Well, good morning, William. We are very honoured to have you with us. And before we talk about The Romantic, let's talk about this new book. It's 300 pages of hefty analysis, an in-depth examination of all your work and quite a bit of your personal life as well. You did it with Alistair Owen, and you must have spent a lot of time with him and had a special rapport with him. How did it all come about?
Well, I'd worked with Alistair before. He did another one of these interview books about screenwriting, and he interviewed, I think, about 20 British screenwriters, and I was one of them. So we had form, you know, we had done it before, and we got on very well. And he suggested, as my big birthday was approaching, the 70 years, that we should do a book like that he'd done before. He'd done a book interview with Bruce Robinson of With Nail and Eye fame, and also with Christopher Hampton, the playwright. So this is his third full-length book of interviews. And I said, I'm never going to write an autobiography, so this may be the best way of getting my thoughts on the record. And so we went during the pandemic, 19 interviews, I think 33 hours of conversation. And Alistair is superbly well prepared for these things. So the questions are always very cogent and to the point. And then he edits them down into what seems like the most natural conversation between two people. But there's a lot of work goes into making it seem effortless.
Well, I was going to say, the amount of work he put into it. I mean, there is not a line of your work he hasn't read, and there's a lot of it to read.
Yes, and he's also read a lot of my unproduced screenplays, you know, which is a thankless task in a way. But no, he's probably, apart from me, the best informed person about my work on the planet.
Can we just talk about the title for a minute? Because it comes from a Stendhal epigraph, doesn't it?
I'm kind of obsessed with Stendhal. I don't think he's much read in Anglophone countries, you know, but he is in France. He's one of the great 19th century authors. And he sort of lurks behind my last novel, The Romantic.
Tell our listeners a bit about Stendhal and who he is, or was, rather.
Well, he was a provincial Frenchman who actually joined the sort of Napoleon civil service. He was on the retreat from Moscow, but he described himself as a romantic. But he saw being a romantic as a kind of disease, a curse, because he's a funny looking little bloke, but he kept falling in love with his friends' wives and actresses and opera singers and things like that, and you know, never had anything go well for him. All his love affairs were either ended in disasters or were unrequited. But he wrote these two classic novels which endure, The Red and the Black and The Charterhouse of Parma. But he was a prolific writer. He wrote travel books, books on music, books on art, etc. And he wound up as a consul in Civitavecchia, which is the port for Rome, which he absolutely hated. This is the middle of the 19th century. And he kind of, you know, frittered away the rest of his life. So he's a most intriguing fellow, Stendhal. It's a pen name. He was called Henri Bayle, in fact. I keep thinking about him. And this particular epigraph is from the Red and the Black, where he defines a novel. He says, a novel is a mirror taking a long walk down a big road. And I sort of think that's a very good description of my kind of novels. And so I used it as an epigraph for this book, and also for the Romantic as well, because he does lurk behind the Romantic considerably.
Can we talk about the Romantic a bit then? Because I absolutely loved it. And it's the first novel that is not at all set in the 20th century.
It's one of my, what I call what my whole life novels, a cradle to grave novel. You start at the very beginning of a character's life and you follow him through his long life up to, in this case, his death at the age of 82. And I've written, this is my fourth proper whole life novel. So I'm sort of carving out a little niche for myself in this sub-genre of English literature. And I was thinking about writing about a romantic. And I spent 8 years of my life failing to complete a PhD thesis on the romantic poet Percy Bysshe Shelley. So I have a store of unused information about the early 19th century. And also I had been reading Stendhal's autobiography as well. And this notion that he had that being a romantic, having a romantic personality is a kind of disease, a malady, also struck me. So I thought, yes, I'll write a book set in the 19th century, which of course was a period of enormous technological change. If you were born like my character, Cashel Greville Ross, in 1799, and you die in 1882, your life has utterly changed. It's coach and horses, turns into railways, letters that took 9 months to get from A to B, got telegraph, instant communication, chamber pot under the bed, flushing toilets. Everything in life had changed. And so it was a very rich backdrop to explore the life of this individual and to see how he coped with this particular character trait that he had, his impulsiveness. He listens to his heart, not his head. And sometimes that can lead to nice things and sometimes it can be disaster. So that was the broad plan.
You've come up with this new, it's not actually new because you say that it's from like Mole Flanders and Defoe, fictography, because he does come across a lot of real people in the book, doesn't he? Byron and Shelley and so on.
Yes, it's something I do in my fiction anyway. I think fiction or the novel is the best way to understand the human condition, human beings, and this curious adventure we're all on this small planet circling its insignificant star. And I just feel that the more real you can make your fiction, the more powerful it is. And so I'd have all sorts of tricks and devices in order to make the reader begin to think, is this true or is this fictional? And one of the things I do is put in real events or put in real people into my novels. And of course, because it's fiction, I'm free to portray them as I think they would have been. And so I don't have the responsibility of a historian or a journalist or a documentary maker or writing reportage. I can just let my imagination rip. And if I think Byron is an overweight snob, then I can portray him as that. You know?
Back to the Mirror and the Road. What I found so astonishing about reading this book was you've read everything. I was really struck by what when you were talking about Solus, when you rewrote one of the, well, not rewrote, but when you reimagined a James Bond book. And you just blithely say, oh, yes, so I sat down and read every single one of the James Bond books and made copious notes. And I just wonder how long would something like that take you? I mean, you just read and read and read and read, don't you, all the time?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I am an avid reader, but I also spent 12 years at universities, you know, studying and then teaching English literature. So I have read my way through the corpus and also a lot of, you know, other literatures, American, French, Italian, Spanish, not to the same degree, but in a way it was my job. And so that kind of background of those years of being in university, studying, teaching English literature, in a way provide me with, you know, a head start on anybody else. But I am an avid reader. And one of the things about writing a doctorate is you do know how to look things up. And so I don't need to read every page of every book I buy. I know how to fill it out the information I want. But in the case of Solo, the Bond novel, I felt, you know, I hadn't read the book since I was a kid, really. I was, 14, 15 when I read Fleming's novels. So I really had to revisit them as an adult. And actually, it was completely fascinating because the portrait of Bond that emerges from that kind of reading is entirely unlike the image everyone has of James Bond. Fleming made him a very complex, troubled, but capable soul. So everything in my novel that seems odd or isn't typical of James Bond is in fact sourced in Fleming. You know, for example, Bond doesn't like women who wear nail varnish. That's from Fleming. Bond is a very nervous flyer. Bond will vomit if he sees something gruesome. He often cries. He's a functioning alcoholic. There's a wonderful line in one of the novels which goes something like, Bond realized that the 13th large whiskey had been a mistake. And you think, well, hang on, that's a bottle and a half, isn't it? And he was a reader. You know, his flat, Fleming describes as book lined. So these little clues allowed me to present a portrait of Bond in my novel, which is set in 1969 when he's 45. So he's a middle-aged man. But I really wanted not only to tell an exciting story, but also to paint an accurate picture of this mythic figure in all the detail that was available to me.
And have you read the new biography of Ian Fleming?
I'm reading it now, actually, because Nicholas Shakespeare, who's written it, is a great friend of mine, and I think he's doing a sensational job, but I'm halfway through it at the moment.
Another thing I learned from The Mirror and the Road is just what a very glamorous life you've had. I mean, you've worked with so many huge directors and movers and shakers in Hollywood. I mean, you've had such a good time with all the films and, you know, hanging out in Bel Air and things. I mean, it was really fun reading about all that.
Yes, it's kind of a parallel career that I always wanted when I became a novelist, back in the early 80s, 1981. I always hoped that it would open the door to writing screenplays and writing, being involved in the movie business for various reasons. A, I love movies. B, it's helped subsidize my novel writing. And C, it gets me out of the house. You know, it's good for my soul. I have colleagues and I go to meetings and all the sorts of things that normal people do. So very quickly after my first novel was published, I was asked by Channel 4 to do one of their first Film on Fours. And so that was the first film I wrote, and I went to the set every day, learned about the business of movie making, and it's gone on from there. I mean, I've written a lot of scripts that haven't been made, but I've had by the standards of a screenwriter, I've had a very good hit rate, about 1 in 3, which is very unusual. And of course, it's random. You know, I've worked with amazing directors, but I've also had projects that have collapsed at the last minute and not been made. So there are lots of disasters. I think that one of the highlights of my film career was working with Dickie Attenborough on his film about Charlie Chaplin, Chaplin, with a very young Robert Downey Jr., who was sensationally good as Chaplin. That had its share of problems as well, but it was probably the biggest film I've worked on. But I like actors. I like the company of actors. Many of my friends are actors. And so part of the pleasure of going to the set and hanging out is that you get to know the actors as friends and you see each other, after the film is over. And I've worked with certain actors several times, it's part of the pleasure quotient, if you like, of the screen trade business.
It's an interesting exercise, isn't it? That because you've done the screenplays of your own books,
yes.
And some of the people we've interviewed, we talked to Maggie O'Farrell about Hamnet, which is being put on the stage, and she was very much of the view. And in fact, I also talked to Mick Herron about Slow Horses on Apple TV. They both sort of take the view, you leave it behind, you hand over the novel to the screenwriter and let them get on with it and don't interfere.
Yes, it's up to you, the writer. But I mean, I insist on adapting my own books, but because I'm a very experienced screenwriter now, and I've even directed a film. I've directed a feature film, so I'm an executive producer on all the films that I work on, and I'm part of the process from start to finish, casting, scoring, post-production. So I think, well, who's better than me at adapting this book? And I also understand the vast difference between the two art forms of a novel and something that's, you know, whether it's a television film or a television miniseries or a movie. They're totally different art forms, and you have to engage totally different gears in your head in order to, you know, make it successful. And so I think, well, I'd rather do it than see somebody else's attempt and think, oh my God, why on earth did they do that?
Oh, I got about four questions that came out of that answer.
Right, okay.
So one is, I love you talking about the casting, and there's a very lovely bit in the book when you really, you know, you're very keen on Daniel Day-Lewis, and somebody in Hollywood goes, who's he? Yes. I bet they're ruining the day now. One of the greatest actors.
We did get him. It was for a film of my novel Stars and Bars, and he had just done My Beautiful Laundrette. So for a Hollywood executive, this little English movie was not exactly calling card. But we won that battle, and we got Daniel to play the lead in Stars and Bars, and he's fantastically good in it.
Mm. Tell us about the movie you directed then.
Well, I'd had a bad experience in Hollywood. I'd written a screenplay of the Gunpowder Plot, you know, the famous 1603 attempt to blow up the House of Lords. And Daniel Day-Lewis had been cast in it, and we had a director who I'd worked with also on Stars and Bars. Pat O'Connor was a good friend of mine. It was being made at Universal Studios in Hollywood. Everything was looking great. We're all set up. And then everybody got fired at the studio, from the top man down about four levels. Then all their projects were thrown out at the same time, and that included the Gunpowder Plot. And I was quite bitter about this. I'd been working on it for about 6 months, and I'd done a lot of free work on it because of Pat and Daniel being friends. And so I thought, well, that's my Hollywood days over. I said, I'm going to go back to London and just work in European film. And then somebody said to me, why don't you direct a film? And I'd had this obsession about World War One, and I'd written a lot about it in my novel New Confessions. And I've always felt that there are very few good films about World War One. And so I had this idea of making a film that concentrated on the nuts and bolts, the nitty gritty of trench life. And it's called The Trench. And it's about a young platoon of soldiers waiting for the Battle of the Somme to begin. So there's no action, really. It's more about what it must have been like to be 18, 19, 20 in the trenches in 1916. And we gathered together a cast of unknowns. I insisted on no stars because I didn't want people to recognize their faces, and very young actors as well, because one forgets that soldiers are young. You know, Tom Hanks as in Saving Private Ryan is 20 years too old to be charging the beaches of Normandy. But in my film, everybody was the right age. And so we got these unknown actors like Daniel Craig and Ben Whishaw and Cillian Murphy, Danny Dyer, Julian Rhind-Tutt, James Darcy. They all had phenomenal, successful careers. But at the time, this is 1998 when he shot the film, they were really not known at all. The most famous actor in it was called Paul Nichols, who'd been in EastEnders. It was a great experience. And I better do another one before I fall off the perch, because I can't just be a one film wonder. But the film is still screened. It has a very big DVD life because of all the famous actors who are in it now. So I owe them a lot for keeping the film alive.
I mean, I think that's one of the things I really learned from the book. It's just how capricious Hollywood is. I mean, time and time again with you, you know, you're about this wonderful project is about to launch, and there's some change of regime at the top that's kind of nothing to do with you, and they just dump all the projects.
Yes, it's, you know, if you don't like the heat, stay out of that kitchen, because it's incredibly random and often unfair. But you've got to have my sort of working maxim in my practice is to have as many irons in the fire as possible, as many irons as the fire can take. So if you've got about 14 or 15 projects, there's a chance that one of them might take off. I just think if you put all your eggs in one basket, it's going to be miserable. So if you've divided your plans and your ambitions, then there's a chance that you might get lucky.
Can we talk about Shakespeare for a minute? Because this is, of course, another side of your great learnedness. And you worked with Catherine Duncan Jones, the great Shakespearean expert.
Yes, yes.
And came up with this theory when you were writing about the Shakespearean sonnets that Shakespeare had got the pox from the dark lady who was a prostitute.
It's a film called A Waste of Shame, and it's about the story, the true story, behind Shakespeare's sonnets. The sonnets, some of them are written to a fair youth and some of them are written to a dark lady. And my theory, and again, it's a drama, it's a fiction, so I'm free to invent, was that Shakespeare had this sort of homosexual love for this aristocratic young man. And at the same time, Shakespeare was a brothel visitor. He became obsessed with this particular prostitute in Southwark, who he referred to as the Dark Lady. And then the young man has an affair with the Dark Lady, much to our Shakespeare's, grief and chagrin. And then at the end of the sonnet sequence, there are two sonnets which are quite clearly about the mercury cure for syphilis. and when they made you sit in a bath of mercury. And it's join the dots. It seems to me incontrovertible, though I can't prove it, that Shakespeare had a dose of the pox. Rupert Graves plays Shakespeare really, really well.
Oh, he's great, Rupert Graves, isn't he? He's got those intense eyes.
And Catherine Duncan Jones, the late Catherine Duncan Jones, who I was incredibly fond of, actually gave me a job at Oxford. She was a don at Somerville College, and I taught there for a year, thanks to her. So it was very nice to be able to pay her back by making her the historical consultant. And she went along with my story. I mean, I wouldn't have dared suggest it if Catherine had disapproved. And she actually appears in the film. In a sort of Hitchcockian walk-on mode as an Elizabethan lady browsing the bookstalls around St. Paul's. So it's a very nice memory. And she was a wonderful woman. And of course, probably the great Shakespeare expert of her time.
Can we just talk about your overall, your novels as a whole now? Because you said somewhere in this book, I mean, it's a big book and you've said an awful lot in it, but you said somewhere that a novel is both funny and cruel. And it, just reading the constant influences that you seem to have had, one is Graham Greene, who's magnificent, obviously, and the other is war. So it's very interesting. You've got that double, the cruelty of life on the one side and the humour on the other.
I describe myself as a realistic novelist. That's what I am. That's the category I put myself. If I was a painter, I would be a figurative painter, not an abstract painter. So I'm a realistic novelist, and I'm trying to create in my novels a world that is real and plausible and meaningful. And of course, we all know what life is like. It's not all, a bed of roses. It can be very cruel and very sad. And so if you're a responsible, serious writer, you sort of have to reflect those aspects of the human condition in your book. Otherwise, you're writing romance, which is, everybody lives happily ever after. So that's why my books, contain, light and shade as well. But, War is a very fascinating man, Evelyn Waugh. I mean, his comedy is utterly ruthless. It's very, very funny, but it's dark, And I think I would describe myself as a comic novelist in that I see the world through that comic absurdist lens. And of course, that includes all the bad stuff as well as the funny stuff. So it's just, my nature and my ambition as a writer to portray the lives we lead or the human condition in as clear-eyed a way as possible.
Of course, at the centre of this book is the novel that so many people have read. If people have only read one of yours, it's probably going to be Any Human Heart. I mean, it just struck such a chord. And you talk in the book about some of the letters you've had that are quite extraordinary.
Yes, I think the thing about Any Human Heart is the format in which it's written. It's written as a journal, and it's a 500-page book. It covers a long life. And the thing about the journal form, as opposed to autobiography or biography or an orthodox novel, is it approximates most closely to the way we live. We live hour by hour, day by day. We don't know what's around the corner. We don't know what's coming up. We don't know if something we do today will have huge significance, or somebody we meet tomorrow will fall in love with, whatever. And so that aspect of the novel, of reading Logan Mountstuart's journals from being a schoolboy right up to this very old man, almost the day he dies, means that you've lived his life as with him, as it were. And I think that's what affects people. They feel at the end of the novel that almost like a member of their family has died, or an old friend has died. But I think it's true of all the whole life novels. The same thing happens in that, because unlike an orthodox novel, you have a bit of a life. It might be 10 years, it might be a month, it might be a year. But in a whole life novel, you've got from birth to death. And so if you've got all the information, and that affects the way you react to the central character, I feel.
And then you talk a lot, and that's really, really interesting, about the series that you did, because you insisted, you said, I'm not having any less than 6 hours. And then, yes. And still you had to chop so much out.
The average adaptation means that you're probably cutting out 50% of the book you're adapting, because the art form of cinema or TV or film just cannot cope with what the novel can do. You know, you can do anything in a novel, but you enter the world of cinema or film and you're in a world of parameters and impossibilities. And so you just can't do half the things that are in the novel. I knew that when I've never thought Any Human Heart would be filmed, but actually I'm really proud of the finished film. And yet there are whole chunks of it that are not in the finished film, but I still think the effect is the same. And it's as moving at the end as the novel is moving. And yet the two art forms are entirely different. And you're always, I keep repeating this, it sounds very stupid or banal, that film is photography. And so you're always looking at the world through a lens. And so you're always on the outside looking on, and it's very objective, and it's very hard to be subjective in a film. Whereas Any Human Heart is entirely subjective, because it's one man's diaries, one man's thoughts. So to transfer that to the screen was a real challenge. And I actually had to make stuff up that isn't in the novel just to satisfy the demands of a six-hour TV series.
Where is your head happiest, writing a novel or writing a screenplay?
Oh, I think writing a novel, without any doubt at all. It's, you're the ultimate one-man band. It's fantastic. I'm never complacent about my good fortune. And, I've been writing for over 40 years now. And, it's a long road, a big road, as Stendhal said. But the fact that I'm doing it, the fact that my books are in print, all in print in this country, in America, in France, Spain, Germany, Italy, is a fantastic thing to know. And my challenge is how do I keep that show on the road, And so it's my main focus. But at the same time, I really enjoy the other writing I do, particularly theatre. I found very stimulating. I do write a lot of journalism as well. So I've always written journalism alongside my novels.
What do you write about when you've got your journalist hat on?
I'm sort of jack of all trades. I review a lot of spy novels, because I've written three spy novels myself. I've reviewed John le Carré's biography. I've reviewed his autobiography. I'm sort of filed under espionage by some literary editors. But I review anything that takes my fancy in a way. I tend to review less fiction these days. But I also write a lot of diary pieces or travel pieces. I write a lot about art as well. So, it's whatever is interesting to me. I'm very interested in photography. So in the last 10 years, I've written a great deal about photography. I've written a lot of introductions to photographic monographs as well.
Are you incredibly disciplined, William? Do you have a regime? I mean, how you fit all this in?
Well, I'm quite disciplined. I mean, I do have fun. I do all the things that everybody else does.
You at a party.
We met at a party. That's true. I go to the movies and hang out with friends and all that sort of thing. But when I'm writing a novel, I do work 7 days a week, but I can only work as I get older. I seem to be sort of firing on all cylinders for about 3 hours. Then I get really tired, brain fag. And so I tend to work after lunch, between lunch and the cocktail hour is my busiest time. But of course, if you're writing screenplays, they often ask you to turn things around very quickly. So I'll write at any time of the day. But writing a novel is a sort of dogged, remorseless process, particularly if it's a long novel. And so you just have to put in those hours at the desk, otherwise it'll never get done. It requires self-discipline. And so I don't give myself any leeway at all.
And your wife, Susan, whom you've been with forever and ever, is she still your first and most scary reader?
Yes, she is. Thank goodness. I think every novelist should have a reader, whether it's their agent or their editor or their companion or spouse or whatever, who is absolutely honest with them. And I think not enough novelists do have that person by their side. And because we know each other so well and we share the same tastes and we have the same sense of humor, and she is a very honest person, so she's not going to soft soap me. But you need that first reader, absolutely. And that's why I dedicate all my books to her, because she makes very, very shrewd and telling remarks, and I trust her instincts absolutely. Because by the end of a novel, you don't know if it's the biggest pile of useless garbage or a work of genius. So you need another pair of eyes to kind of refocus your own inclinations, your own instincts, and that's what Susan does for me.
What's her favorite?
That's what Maggie O'Farrell said about her husband.
Oh, right. Yes. Well, he's a novelist, I think, isn't he?
Yes. Yes.
Well, I think Susan's favorite novel of mine is my first whole life novel, The New Confessions.
Oh, yes.
Which is a story, again, it goes from sort of 1899 to the 1970s, but it's about a Scottish film director. And it's in the form of an autobiography. And again, you might think, did this guy actually exist? You know, so, I wrote it. It was published in 1987, so it was a long time ago. She does like my other books as well. I think that's always the one she says to people, that's my favourite.
Can I ask the sort of slightly tedious and superficial question at the end, which is, is there a favourite novelist of yours, a person whose entire sort of work you'd probably say, that is my favourite novelist? And obviously, given your other career as a screenwriter, is there a favourite film?
I think at the moment, my favourite writer is Anton Chekhov. But Anton Chekhov, the short story writer, not the playwright. And again, I have had an obsession with Chekhov for many years, and I've written a lot about him. I've written a short story about him, and I've adapted two of his short stories into a play, and I'm adapting a short story into an opera, believe it or not. And Chekhov died in 1904 when he was 44, but he was a very modern spirit. And the short stories are sensationally good, and I think have influenced all literatures. So I also like Vladimir Nabokov, another Russian writer. But I think Chekhov is the current favorite. And as for films, I think films do thrillers really well. I think my favorite film is Chinatown. Ooh. With Jack Nicholson.
Polanski,
yes. Mm. Probably that's, the thing about Chinatown is it's an original script by Robert Towne, the writer. It's not an adaptation. And so it plays to the strengths of cinema, and you have this highly complicated thriller plot, but also you have two amazing movie stars, Jack Nicholson and Faye Dunaway, at the absolute apotheosis of their careers. And I must have seen that film seven or eight times, and it's an absolutely brilliant movie. But, being a screenwriter, I would say it's thanks to Robert Towne's amazing talent in constructing the story, and then the good luck of Polanski casting Jack Nicholson and Faye Dunaway, because they really are fabulous in the film. And it's dark, it's very dark. There's an interesting story that Towne had written a happier ending. I don't know if you remember the John Huston character, but Polanski and Robert Evans, who was the head of Paramount at the time, persuaded him to change it to the ending we have now. And if you remember, Faye Dunaway and her daughter, incestuous daughter, is led off by the John Huston character. Jack Nicholson, Jake Gittes, is outraged. And the guy turns and says, "It's Chinatown, Jake." And that's a very, very dark ending, and it works. And Rob, one of the few occasions where the director and the producer were right and the writer was wrong.
Given I'm on a roll, that my question wasn't as stupid as I thought it was. Favourite actor?
Well, that's very difficult because I've worked with so many great actors, and it, in a way, it depends on the role, you know. And you know, I've worked twice with Daniel Craig. He's a brilliant actor, not just as a brilliant Bond, but as an actor. I worked with the late Michael Gambon. You know, there are too many. Actually, I can't answer that one, Ed. There are too many.
Okay, but you've got two names.
Yeah.
You've got us two names, and you've got all our listeners are now running to Waterstones to get their Chekhov short stories. So it's
right.
Yeah. Useful exercise. Exactly. Going on to whichever streamer they favour to rewatch Chinatown.
Yes, excellent.
Well, thank you, William. I mean, you've certainly given me an enormous amount of joy over the years. I've, you know, love your books, and what an absolute privilege to have had you on the podcast. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed myself enormously. Thank you both.
Very sadly, that's all we have time for this week, but what a privilege to have been in conversation with William Boyd, whose novels I've been reading and loving for many years. Next week, we're going to be talking to the actor Robert Bathurst, who became one of the most recognisable and enduringly popular faces on television screen and in the theatre after taking on the role of David in Cold Feet. He's now reprising the title role in Geoffrey Bernardi's Unwell, a role first played by Peter O'Toole in 1989. But rather than in a theatre, the play is being staged in Geoffrey Bernard's favourite Soho pub, The Coach and Horses. With Robert will be Trish Wadley, the theatre producer who has championed immersive theatre and has had huge success with staging Tennessee Williams Hotel plays in hotel bedrooms, and is a passionate believer that good play doesn't need to rely on an actual theatre to attract enthusiastic and new audiences. So that's going to be a lot of fun. See you next week. Goodbye.